Cool. So we're live right now, huh?
Yeah.
Love Talk Radio.
It's a special edition of Graphic Policy Radio, and I've got two special guests with us tonight. We have Spencer Toyama. Am I pronouncing it right?
Yeah.
Cool.
Yes, sir.
And John Lewis. The reason we're having them on, which is, first welcome and thanks for joining us, is they've got an awesome Kickstarter project called, was it Brave New World?
Home of the Brave.
I didn't do my query quick enough. Home of the Brave. And what it is a comic book that's going to be putting on spotlight about poverty and slavery. It's really cool. It's a great idea. Throw massive props to them for doing it. So, first, welcome to the show. Appreciate you guys doing it.
Thanks, boss.
Thank you.
I'm sure it's a little weird. So I guess we'll start off. What's your background as far as creating comics and just being part of comic book industry?
I'll go first. We have no background in the comic book industry. This is our first book, and we're first-time creators, and we're just really excited. I think both of us have just been long-time fans of the graphic storytelling medium, and we've been to cons in the past, but this is our first venture into creating anything. Or John, you have any other experience?
I don't have any experience at all, no. I did a webcomic when I was in high school, but that's because everybody was doing webcomics when they were in high school. So
What was the webcomic that you were doing?
It was like a really nerdy, I'm going to build a time machine and play with dinosaurs and stuff. It was weird.
Okay.
It was really strange. Nothing came of it.
We're going to have to search it down and pull it out from the...
It's been nuked. Don't worry about it. It's gone. I took care of it. Coup de grace.
So, I have to throw you guys massive props on the project. Where did the idea come about? We'll just start off as in your own words, describe what the project and what you're trying to get funding from for.
Sure. The project started, just with an interest in the humanities and human trafficking in general. I used to, this is Spencer, by the way, I don't know if our voices sound on the podcast, but I was really interested in exploring American history, and I was reading things Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States, and all these hidden stories about slavery in the U.S., and I just thought they were really interesting, thought it'd make a really good graphic novel, because they have adventure, they have romance, and all this other crazy drama. And so I wanted to create something that was, reflective of that history. But then I got really interested in modern slavery and thought that we could do something that addresses that and brings awareness to the issue of modern-day human trafficking. And so we created a story about human trafficking in America that is a third world nation.
Yeah, so we're so it's interesting. So it's like a futuristic story,
it's a modern day story. Get that a lot. A lot of people think that it's a futuristic story.
Okay, I messed up on that. Yeah, so when I first
go ahead.
Yeah, when I first read it, it seemed like it was kind of like that near future America. That was kind of my take. So it's more modern day, is what you're saying?
Yeah. Well, the crux of the story is that America never recovered from the Great Depression, and so it just got more into poverty and deteriorated, and so America is now suffering from the. In the same way that a lot of third world nations or extreme poverty nations are suffering.
So it's more like an alternate history.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, cool. Very cool. So where like, why are you doing this in a, like, a more, handling it through comic books?
Because we love comic books.
Well, I mean, did you, was there, like, a thought of, like, oh, maybe we could do a documentary about this, oh, we could do a prose book about it, or maybe just do some blog series about it? Like, is there something of particular about that, about, like, that storytelling that you were interested in?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, well, but I think we chose graphic storytelling because, one, we're really in love with the medium, and graphic storytelling, comic books, graphic novels actually have a really great history behind it as far as their ability to make an impact on culture and generationally. Like Superman in the 1930s used to fight corrupt business people and like slumlords and stuff. He wasn't fighting Brainiac back then. I think there's comic books have always been in the forefront of addressing like things like social justice with Green Lantern and Spider-Man in the 1970s. And I think that's where a lot of my influence comes from as a writer, those really influential, culturally influential stories. And also, we didn't have the budget to make a documentary or anything, or like a feature or anything like that. And the thing about comic books is that, you know, we can create really amazing things and really amazing landscapes without having to put the money in to have a studio and actors and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's, I mean, it's one of those that, you know, going to the idea of comics as like a political medium, it's something, and I've done it, said it in a couple of interviews with some other folks, is to me, comics have always been like a political medium from the beginning. Like, even if you go back to when it was just comic strips, those comic strips were very much like commentary about class systems of those days. And then you had Superman fighting, you know, not Brainiac, not Lex Luthor, but mobsters and the KKK. I mean, you bring that up as an example in your Kickstarter was the infamous radio show where that was, like, the big bad guy. And then you even had, like, the other thing a lot of people know is Captain America advocating to enter World War II before, you know, a year before Pearl Harbor happened. So as a whole, like, it's got this nice history to it. You know, is there a thought as to, like, maybe why that's the case? Why is this such a political medium as opposed to, like, maybe television or movies or anything else?
I don't know that comic books are exclusively political. I feel like there's a lot of leeway for comic books to be a really great form of expression in that area. But I feel like all media has its places in that with that voice, but comic books have just been around for a really long time, and kind of have this, history to them, where people are telling stories with the same characters over and over and over again, and they start to withhold these values. You know, it's hard to do that with like a television show or like a film franchise, you know, like James Bond or something like that would probably, you know, not ever really stray into something as different as what like the stories are normally based off of. But I don't know, I feel like people read comic books and other people just kind of look at them as a gateway to other mediums too. So by making comic books, you're kind of saying like, oh, I'm going to put this story down and I'm going to let people read it. And eventually it may be adapted to this other, some other mediums that are a little more mainstream, you know, like film and television and things like that. So comic books was a really easy way for us to kind of like, financially easy for us to, it's very difficult to make a comic book.
Yeah.
But, financially, I mean, you know, we're able to basically go crazy and tell whatever story we want and not be held back by, like, you know, a board of directors or money or
and going to
printing, really.
Yeah, and you guys are very smartly, and this is something that seems like perfect for Kickstarters, going around kind of like the establishment publishing and companies Did you approach anyone to make this happen, or did you say screw it?
Publish the
Kickstarter?
Book. No, yeah. We went straight to Kickstarter.
All right. What was your draw to Kickstarter as opposed? Like, did it even cross your mind of like, no, screw it, we're not even going to do this?
Pretty much. I think. Oh, I don't think we ever wanted to get a publisher.
It's just the two of us, and my take on crowdfunding for comic books. It's kind of perfect because the main reason you would want a publisher would be probably for marketing and to pay for your printing costs and possibly get an advance. And we didn't really want an advance. We just wanted to tell our story. We wanted to get it out to as many people as possible. And so in order to cover our printing costs, we could approach the Kickstarter community for that. And it mm-hmm. also works as a really good marketing tool because it is a social network and ties into other social networks. So we're able to get the word out about our book by basically running a campaign through Kickstarter. So it kind of hit two birds with one stone. And additionally, we got to we got to keep all of our rights to the book.
Right.
So if we ever wanted to license it out for something, then we're not at the behest of, like a publisher or someone else that holds that license.
It's interesting. Is like a lot more of the political stuff. The other thing I think of right off the top of my mind is Occupy Comics have just said, forget it for publishers. We're just going to Kickstarter as a whole and kind of getting around, just the normal, politics of publishing. I mean, do you think if you did go and try to go through the normal channels, like what would your gut say the response would be? Or, do you even not think of what the response would be or don't care what the response would be?
It's hard to say. I mean, like, I've never tried to get a book published by talking to a publisher about anything. I talked to some people about the process that has to go through and everything, but I feel like it's more work than necessary at this point with the, because we have the internet, and we're like, being in Hawaii is a perfect, we're a really good example of why our idea makes sense. Because up until the day that we started our Kickstarter campaign, nobody knew who we were. We didn't have any fans, and Kickstarter is a really good way for you to establish your fan base and to have people validate your idea and your story before it even gets printed, So if you were going to go to a publisher, they'd probably be making all those decisions for you. Who's going to read this? What artist do I pair with this writer? And how do I handle this? And what are the opportunities for the publishing house? All that. We just want to tell the story, and if we can get people to help us get it into other people's hands, then the publisher kind of is unnecessary,
Yeah, is there any, has anyone approached you about that, about using it? I mean, this seems to be, like, such a great tool for raising awareness of this issue. Like, has any nonprofit said, hey, once this is done, we'd love to help distribute it, or even any publisher that said, hey, this is great, if you succeed, we'd like to take it the next step?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There's the Pacific Alliance to Stop Slavery, which is a local group that addresses human trafficking issues in Hawaii. We've teamed up with them, and we've done fundraising events with them. According to Kickstarter rules, we can't actually use money from the project to go to them, but what we did was at our we had a launch party, and we had all the alcohol donated. Luckily, Jim Beam was nice enough to donate, maybe about a lot of alcohol. I think they gave away 800 drinks that night. And we had all of the bar go directly to the Pacific Alliance to Stop Slavery. So all the cash from that night went to a really good cause. And while we were in New York, we actually met up with the Somali Mom Foundation, which is a really great international human trafficking organization. And so we're going to help them out with some graphic design and social media things, because that's what John and I do at our day jobs. Is he's a graphic designer for, it's called the Agency Collaborative out here, and I do some of the operations management and social media there.
Nice. Yeah, I mean, I was going to just give you my next question, because, I mean, my day job is politics, and I mean, looking at, I mean, you've got this graphics that says State of the Union. It's on the Kickstarter, and the way it's laid out, it's designed to it, everything about it. Like, I'm looking at this thinking, this is better than most of the graphics of a lot of nonprofits and organizations put out nowadays.
Thanks, dude.
So that was going to be my next question. exactly what you guys do, because I was like, shit, I think people could be, you know, be learning a lot from the stuff that you're laying out. I mean, it's the project itself, like this graphics, I'm looking at it right now. I mean, it's just easy to read, gives you the stats, draws your eye in. It's like really, and it's fantastic. Everything you guys have thrown up so far that I've seen has been awesome.
Yeah, that's probably your two times.
Yeah,
so on.
Too much.
Tell me more.
So it's a graphic novel that you're putting out, 135 pages. Have you thought about maybe what's next after this? You know, they're going to be thought about volume two, or maybe other issues you wanted to take on, or you know, something else you want to do with the graphic novel after.
More Home of the Braves, yes. Yeah, we've kind of planned this out like a Harry Potter type of thing. I don't know. That's like a weird way to put it. Yeah, it's hard to compare it to Harry Potter when there's like child rape in the book.
Yeah, it's a little twisted.
Yeah, but we did plan it out in about five or six arcs, depending on how we divvy it up. But there's definitely a long-term plan and a definitive ending to the whole thing.
Okay, it's actually really cool. And what, when it comes to the youth Kickstarter, like what barriers have you run into, troubles that you've kind of, lessons that you've learned so far going through it all for people that might be thinking about using the system?
Oh, man, I don't know. I feel like John likes the joke that, I have a habit of jumping the shark a lot.
Oh yeah, there's been a lot of shark jumping. We definitely had a strategy from the beginning about how we wanted to make a splash with the Kickstarter, and we kind of looked at a lot of projects and looked at a lot of the numbers across Kickstarter, you know, like comic book section especially, and you know, there's certain types of projects, you know, there's anthology books where somebody will put together a book with a whole bunch of different artists and storytellers in it, and then there's books from people that have huge followings, like webcomic people, and Penny Arcade raised like, you know, $10 million or something insane like that. And then there's guys like us that nobody knows, you know. So you know, we kind of had to plan it properly and use all of our resources to make sure that everything was executed right. But I feel like if you're going to start a Kickstarter, you should definitely come at it with a plan. You know, don't have a plan, because that's the worst thing that could possibly happen to you. They run you through your paces as if you're going to start a business, you know. And I feel like that's what's really great about Kickstarter, is that if it wasn't for that, you know, you would a lot of people would skip a lot of really important steps, you know, logistically and like in their production and timing of things and all of that. We planned our Kickstarter to coincide with New York City Comic Con, the presidential election, you know, all these other things that are happening locally, and just happened to work out in a very pleasant way so far.
Yeah, a lot of it's one of the panels I tend to go to is the Kickstarter ones that have been at conventions. It seems all of them kind of reiterate is like, whatever you think you're getting into, doing a Kickstarter project almost feels like it's, you know, turns into a full-time job. Is that something that you guys have experienced? Or, I mean, is it, you got into it and like, holy crap, it's way even more than what we expected? Not in a bad way, like overwhelming, but just, you know, there's more to it than even you planned on?
A little bit of both, I think. I've been involved in other people's Kickstarter campaigns.
Okay.
And that raised gold and asked for way, way more money than I would need to make a book, you know, like film projects and stuff like that. And it's different when it's your project, you know, and it belongs explicitly to you, and you have this very real responsibility to all these people that are backing you. But
it's a really good feeling to know that you have all these strangers that want to, you know, see more of your work and want to see you succeed.
Yeah, my advice to anyone that's trying to get a Kickstarter off the ground is your first 24 hours is just don't sleep.
Yeah,
just stay up, work every social network that you can, and go by time zone. So if you know that the East Coast is up, then try to contact everyone you can in every possible way you can to post about your project. Because for us, because we didn't have a web comic, we didn't have any kind of web following, we were relying just on our friends to spread the word. We knew that it was really crucial to get on the Kickstarter front page, or no one would know who we are. And so what we did is we very strategically asked all of our friends on by time zone, can you post about our project? Can you post about our project? So I think that first 24 hours, I sent probably about 20 or like probably about 400 text messages that day.
And, really, really smart.
Yeah, I contacted everyone I had on Facebook, every Twitter friend that I had, and just get them to post about the project. I didn't ask to donate, so they pledged. A lot of them ended up sending anyway. But that was part of the strategy, is just to make sure that the word was out all at once. So I think our first 6 hours we raised about $3,000 or $4,000,
yeah,
which is about a third of our goal. And because of that, we ended up being on the popular section for Kickstarter on the overall project. And on the front section of the comic book project, just because we had so much volume happening all at once.
It's a really, really, really sounds like a very like planned out, smart way of going out about it. So I'm pretty impressed by that, because you know, a lot of the people I've talked to about Kickstarter, it seems they just kind of go in and be like, oh, I'm going to post it and email people and tweet about, you know, to some friends and maybe do some posts, and it just kind of goes from there. So
that was
sounds like you guys, yeah, sounds like you had a hell of a strategy going in. And what about the comic end? I mean, neither of you, you know, you've created some web comics before, but you know, what lessons have you gone into? What have you learned? You know, actually putting together the graphic novel itself.
Oh man, I've learned so much about narrative and sequential art in general, like just beyond storytelling, which I feel like I've always had a solid grasp on storytelling, but like actually illustrating a book, the process that I have a really, really strange process. And at some point I'll document it for people so that they can see just what goes on in my head. But normally, you know, when you're making a book, you have multiple people, you know, doing all these different things, and the actual artistic process is pretty similar across the board, you know, pencils, inks, colors, letters, design, and then it goes to print or whatever. But I've got, like, actually having to do all the layouts for 130 pages before I even, commit to real pencils is, was nuts. The script went through loads and loads of revisions before I was able to start layouts. So, you know, like, to tackle the book from that big chunk, you know, like 130 pages as opposed to, like, you know, a short kind of 20-page story, and to have that be the first book that I work on is crazy. So there was a lot of foresight into, you know, like, how do I make this economical for myself to illustrate and still, you know, keep a style that I think people are going to be interested in. And finding that balance was tough. I really, really wanted to do, like, a really short test run. But and I guess the 30-page preview was perfect for that, because it cuts off at a point that's very natural. You know, it doesn't feel like you're losing much, you know, like it's definitely a good cutoff point for a short. But the rest of the book, it's like we couldn't give you an extra, not even another page after that, without, you know, getting you super, super deep into the story. A lot happens after the 30 page. It's massive.
Hmm. I mean, is there is there stuff that you maybe getting far into the process that you would have gone back and be like, I would have done this different, Miriam would have done this different, or are you just pretty much
absolutely.
Like...
Yeah, absolutely. There's all kinds of stuff that I would redo, and doing the 30-page preview was something where I was able to take the process from beginning to end for a chapter out of the book, and because of that, I know that there's going to be obstacles that I'm going to have to face further in the book where there's going to be even bigger problems, and I know what those problems are, so I can fix them before they happen. Not to say that there's problems with the 30-page preview. They've been fixed, too, but just the amount of work that goes into, like, actually printing something on top of that, you know, is pretty nuts. You know, like, planning to print the books and then taking them to New York and handing them out to people and, you know, hitting up all the comic book shops and all of that. I mean, I feel like that's something that you kind of have to do if you want people to know who you are and you want them to take you seriously, because otherwise you're just sending somebody a download
yeah.
saying, hey, read my book, you know?
What type of reaction did you get from the comic shops that you go to or the people you handed it to?
There's some cool people. Some cool people. Yeah, we were we basically ran around all of New York trying to find every comic book shop we could, and we went everywhere from Time Machine, which was like a. But are you in New York? You're like in Manhattan.
I'm in D.C., but I know a good chunk of the stores up there. I usually hit them up when I go up for New York Comic Con.
Oh yeah. If you've ever been a Time Machine, it's like this. It feels like the comic shop that you went as a kid, and there's just like old books and old posters
it's
all around.
It's like an above ground bomb shelter. Love it.
It was awesome, and so we dropped off books there, and then the more well known are like Midtown Comics. Everyone kind of knows Midtown.
Jim Halley's Universe.
Yeah, Jim Halley's Universe is actually super awesome. They're like right across the Empire State Building, and they were actually really, really supportive of us and took pictures of the books and asked us to sign them and stuff. That was super cool.
Yeah.
Nice. That's it. So when it comes to actually the story itself, like what type of research did you do? I mean, or did you just go with there's this issue, we're familiar with the issue, we're going to go into it, or was there more like a deeper, like a lot of research into, you know, the realities of it? I mean, did you talk to people involved?
Yeah, I went through training with the Pacific Alliance to Stop Slavery to as far as how to address human trafficking survivors.
Mm-hmm.
So I heard a lot of crazy stories as far as what a lot of these girls go through. So that was part of it. But I based a lot of the psychology on human trafficking more on Howard Zinn, the People's History, and his exploration of slavery in the 1600s to the 1800s. And we actually got to sit down with the Somali Mom Foundation, which didn't make it into the preview, but we're definitely taking some of their influences into the next book. And Somali Mom's book, she wrote this book called The Road of Lost Innocence, which is an amazing, crazy book that makes our work. I thought we were doing something really graphic and really crazy, and that's going to make people's stomachs turn. And what actually happens in real life is so much worse.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that was going to be my next question. Was, I mean, did you? You know, I mean, it's a brutal thing that's occurring. I mean, I know a little of the issue, and I just know how, you know, disgusting some stuff is and how horrible this is in general. I mean, did you feel points like, oh my, this is almost too graphic for this, and you wanted to like almost self-censor yourself, or you're like, screw it, we need to show warts and all? Or, you know, as you just mentioned, like there's more out there that's even more graphic than what you guys put in.
okay, well, here's the thing. The layouts that I have for the rest of the book are, I'm comfortable with where they're at graphically, like in terms of like getting an idea across but I'm also a little like less sensitive to the average reader. You know, like I feel like I'm one of those guys that's seen like every scary movie, and I'm pretty desensitized in terms of like the media, right? But because we have this idea that we need to pay respect to, there's a line that I can't go over, even though I would like to, in order to make things grungy, you know. But so I'm holding myself back a little bit graphically, but I feel like a lot of it is driven by character work, and mm-hmm. and because our characters are so strong, it makes the situations that they're in more realistic.
Yeah, you know? I guess
so
that's all.
Even though the art is really crazy, you know, the characters are really, really real, and that balance I think is difficult to maintain.
Yeah, I guess the thought would be, it's the worst word to use for it, but like, you struggle with it almost being like exploitative in the actual depiction.
Right.
I mean, and it's not it's the right word, but at the same time, it's the wrong word because you know that's what's
right.
Happening.
I mean, I wouldn't be doing it explicitly to exploit anything. It's just that you know, like I have an idea of what I feel like would be effective.
Yeah.
But effective isn't always appropriate. You know, that level of effectiveness, and you know, so. I mean, there's definitely some parts that, like, no matter what, are just really difficult for me to illustrate just on principle because they're, you know, outrageously, you know, just the idea that it is crazy. But that there's an audience that we're trying to reach that's broader than the people that read really crazy, insane stuff. We don't want to turn people away with anything, you know. We want it to be approachable, but it's just not for kids, that's all.
Yeah, I mean, as a whole, it's an issue that's, you know, not, you know, kids are, it's great for them to be aware, but when you really get into
right.
the reality of it, it's not something
yeah.
I would want my kid digging into, because it's pretty brutal.
Yeah, and I feel like we get this comparison a little bit to things like Mouse, which is a very sensitive subject to a lot of people,
mm-hmm.
and they were able to address it really poignantly without, you know, I don't want to say they weren't afraid of offending people, because they were definitely not afraid of offending people with that book, but they wanted to convey something without being exploitative and without kind of glorifying the misery of the Holocaust. And I think we're trying to straddle the same line, and
yeah.
we don't want to glorify that. We don't want to make child sex slavery sexy in any way. We really want to explore how it affects characters and what it does to people, and what we can do about it.
Yeah, I mean, even you using your example of Mouse. I mean, Mouse was pretty controversial when it first came out.
Right. I like Mouse a lot. Like, I feel like it's probably the closest. It's a really good approach, you know,
mm-hmm.
to take this idea and then spin it into this into something that's palatable, you know, by not having humans. You know, like that's kind of an amazing device to frame things in.
Was there other comics that you look towards, works that you look towards when putting this together?
I don't want to say specific books really, but there are definitely like inspirations from all different types of like cartooning, I'd say. Like in terms of layout and things like that, I've always really liked Bill Watterson and like a lot of like Chuck Jones and Hanna-Barbera type stuff, just because everything is super economical, and the way that cartoons and comic strips were laid out, you know, ages ago was something that was all about storytelling. You know what I mean? Where you placed a word balloon was not always, it was something that had to be calculated, but, you know, it seemed like nobody was really thinking about it. And, you know, those guys are kind of like masters because they made it look easy. And, when I'm the only artist working on the book, like I have to think about all these things, you know, where's everything going to go? I have to solve all these problems in my head, and I kind of look to people that had to do the same thing, you know, when they were making cartoons, and like Chuck Jones is a really good example, and like the art direction that he used for things like Wile E. Coyote and The Roadrunner, like reusing assets and things like that. So the design work in the book is, a lot of it is recycled throughout the book. And it builds the landscape and creates a tone and all of this stuff. And it makes it easier for me to produce a story quickly instead of having to, you know, spend three times as long working on a single page. You know, I can do... it's definitely not fast. It's not as fast as I would like it to be. But, the economy of scale, I think, for producing the artwork is, like, the thing that I look for in my inspiration.
What about the actual the story itself? Is there anything comic-wise?
I'm probably influenced by a bunch of different writers. I mean, I like everyone from... Mark Miller to Alex Robinson, love a lot of Brian Michael Bendis' early work with Torso and Jinx, that kind of stuff. But I don't think you can ever abandon your influences. Every writer tries to find their own voice, but ultimately there's always that little residue of the writers that you love. Michael Chabon is probably my biggest influence. With The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay. I'd say actually that's probably the biggest one, of just the way that he found the poignancy and but was also pulling in all these kind of historical things and bringing in contemporary issues and still managed to tell a fantastic story with his novel. I don't put myself up to those standards because he's kind of a brilliant madman, but maybe someday I would love to be.
Interesting. Solid stuff. Yeah, I mean, some solid stuff that was thrown out there. Some like really good series stuff and fantastic writers. Is there anything else you guys kind of want to say before we wrap up?
Can I plug some nonprofits? Is that cool?
Yeah, exactly. Like, if you want to go there, like, I'm not familiar with all those nonprofits, so you kind of got the floor. I mean, it's a great project, so,
Sweet. Let's create some good out there. I mean, I would love it if listeners actually checked out and got informed about female trafficking issues with organizations like the Somali Mom Foundation. They do a lot of international human trafficking work. They actually rescue young girls from Cambodia and Thailand and Vietnam from sexual slavery. And the other one that we've been working with is Daughters Rising, which do preventative services for girls that are in danger of being sex slaves. And a lot of people don't realize that these girls that are often being taken to human trafficking are very, very young, because if the sex education in Southeast Asia is really terrible, in that there's a belief amongst the men there that they can cure their AIDS by having sex with virgins. And for a long time, I thought that was just like a joke that they put into Book of Mormon, but it's actually true and something that some of the men out there pursue. And so what that does is it makes the age of sex slavery victims younger and younger. And so while the median age might have been like 13 or 14, maybe 20 years ago, now we're seeing girls being taken in that are as young as like 4 or 5 years old.
How would people get involved? Like, what would you suggest that people can do to get involved? Or let's start back. What can people do to become more aware about the issues?
Sure. I would definitely recommend some reading, like Somali Mom's book. Her name is spelled Somaly, and they have a website, somali.org. But it always starts with awareness, and they're aware that a lot of people can't donate money or don't have time to volunteer. But I think something very easy that everyone can do is to start dialogues with it and just spread awareness about, you know, hey, have you heard about this? Or being involved with the social media, I'd say subscribing to Somali Mom Foundation social media, like their Twitter feed, their Facebook pages, all of that, and just retweeting or sharing some of the articles will, you know, it'll help spread the message a little bit at a time, but a little bit is better than nothing. And we really wanted to work with them to get awareness up, so when we can bring like things like legislation in the United States to help address our own human trafficking issues, it won't be such a battle to enact legislation. Like right now in Hawaii, we actually are trying to address legislation to battle human trafficking. Currently, it's technically legal for a police officer in Hawaii to sleep with a human trafficking victim if it's part of an investigation. And that's kind of controversial because, you know, would they be able to do the investigation without doing so? I mean, I tend to think they probably would. It'd probably endanger the investigation a little bit more. But at least we can bring it to the attention of voters that this is something that we might want to address and at least hear what voters have to say about something like that. But without awareness, then we don't really have we won't be able to address it because people have no idea what they're voting for, even if we do get it to any kind of like state senate floor or even on a federal level. Like if there's a federal human trafficking legislation bill, then we would like the public to be well informed about those issues before they pass the ballot for those or for senators that would support those kind of issues or not support those kind of issues.
And what would you suggest as people getting involved? I mean, there's education, tweeting, you know, sharing stuff on Facebook, you know, just starting talking about the issue as a whole and educating themselves. But even bigger would be, you know, what other than that, you know, what suggestions do you have about
even
getting
bigger,
involved?
Even bigger, yeah, all of these organizations need money. If you go to somali.org, they definitely need money. Daughters Rising, they're in need of money, or even Fine Services. Something that that John and I were able to do after visiting them in New York is that we, since we work in social media and technology, we were able to get in touch with a translation and interpretation company that translates things through smartphones, and it's not solidified yet, but it looks like they're probably going to do some pro bono services for human trafficking, which is a huge help because not only that would take thousands of dollars, but even if anyone out there has access to, you know, bilingual translators and like in Southeast Asian languages, getting in touch with those organizations and helping them out with translation services or social media or design or programming.
Hey, yeah, no, if you're a nerd like us, there's actually a whole lot that you can do, like any type of nerd, mostly because nonprofits don't have the resources to allocate to make things look pretty or to make things interesting and palatable to the general audience. So, like, when we went to go visit Somali Mom, I was really excited that they were interested in having me help out with their design work, because if I can make it easy for the average person to give them money or to learn something or something like that, to present information in a easy to digest way, then that is a lot of help. You know what I mean? So if you feel like you are out there and there's nothing that you can do, there's a huge chance there's something that you can do. You know, everything helps, really, but education is where it starts. And I mean, there's even if reading and all that isn't your thing for some reason, there's a PBS film that came out called Half the Sky, and it's kind of got like it's an amalgamation of a lot of different stories and things like that. And it's kind of where I've been telling people to start if they want to know more about what's going on, because it's visceral. You know what I mean? It's visual and audible, as opposed to like locking yourself into a room and reading a really, really, really depressing kind of story. This is something that was made for very broad audience. You know, PBS is, you know, that's for everyone, basically. And the film aired, what was it, like 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, beginning of the month? Something like that. And it got incredible press, and it has a lot to do with Simone Mom and a lot of the books that we just mentioned. But yeah, I mean, you kind of have to join everybody in the same mindset and understand what your place is in helping, because, I mean, that's kind of the curse of nonprofits, right, where you have all these people trying to accomplish the same goal, but a lot of their work overlaps, and there's a lot of energy that's wasted. So if you can mobilize with people and, you know, figure out where you fit in best, then you'll do a lot more good, I think, for everyone.
Yeah, and I actually think the comic book audience is kind of perfect for this, because we all grew up watching, you know, Batman and Superman just do the right thing time after time. And I think there is something in all of us, especially us comic book nerds that are like, you know, I've always, personally, I feel like I'm speaking on behalf of the comic book community in that I've always felt like I really wanted to be a hero. And getting involved with these organizations, it's really fulfilling in that sense, because most of us have always wanted to do something really heroic, and we don't know where to start. And I didn't know where to start. We made this book, and it's part of, you know, it's kind of an awareness thing, but I feel like we're actually doing something that is benefiting humanity, and being able to use this book as a platform to talk about these very real issues, and hopefully convincing some of the other comic book nerds out there that also grew up wanting to be heroes their entire life, sitting on a cape and maybe jumping out a window or two. Like, you know, I'm hoping that creates some kind of action, and a lot of us will get involved and try to change the world for the better.
Yeah, I mean, I think you guys say it best on the Kickstarter campaign, is pop culture can make a difference. I think it's the perfect example of that. You know, it's got a long history of doing so, and, you know, you guys are keeping up this fine tradition and taking on a very important issue that, unfortunately, you know, doesn't have as much awareness or focus as really should. But, you know, again, absolutely applaud you guys in doing it, and I'll be following up with you guys afterwards of some ways to help out as a whole. So I mean, again, like, kudos for folks who might be interested. You can go to Kickstarter, just do a query of Home of the Brave. There's 10 days to go, roughly, in the project. It ends on November 10th. So, you know, give whatever you can. I've chipped in my money. I'm actually probably going to up my pledge to one of the higher levels, because, you know, it really is. It's just a great project. It's one of those things where a few times that you can actually, you know, get a cool comic out of it and raise awareness of a important cause. So, you know, massive props to you guys. Applause. Oh. All around.
No, and thank you so much, and for everyone else that's contributed. I think we have a great audience, and everyone that's pledged, I try to write to all of them, and everyone's been really super responsive and supportive. So thank you
backers,
yeah,
superheroes.
If any of you guys are listening, thank you so much. We're just baffled at how much support we've been getting.
So, yeah, I mean, you know, thank you for guys for doing this project, for everyone that's contributed and will contribute. Again, you know, thank you guys. I mean, it's, you know, I think this is a great example of comics at their best. So, kudos, congrats. You know, looking forward to the end product when I actually get it in my hands. Really look forward to reading it, and thank you for your taking the time to chat with us.
Oh, thanks so much. Thanks.
So, yeah, I appreciate it. And everyone listening, you know, thank you. Go give Kickstarter, you know, Home of the Brave. You can do a quick query. There's actually hashtag of Be Brave if you want to get in the conversation.
Be Brave.
chip in your money. Art looks great. Awesome cause. Can't recommend it enough. So.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you guys.
Thanks, man. Be brave. Later.